readers, welcome to the Book Report. This is your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we're going undercover to examine a genre that I adore, the spy thriller. There's a new 007 out, and we're actually going to be speaking with author Jeffrey Deaver today. Of course, I was just a young kid when Mr. Bond burst onto the scene, but after Dr. No, it was yes, 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 I was hooked. I started reading all the novels and waited in long lines on opening weekends to see each and every film. For my vote, Sean Connery will always be the Bond, but hey, Daniel Craig is lots of fun to watch, and you know what I mean. The genre is so rich and so much fun. Our mission, should we decide to accept it, and we will, is to get started.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
A prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post, David Ignatius has penned Blood Money, a novel of espionage, a riveting suspense tale ripped from today's headlines. Deep within Pakistan's border, a secret CIA team is being systematically dismantled by a cunning enemy. Soon, Sophie Marks, a young, ambitious agent, is on the ground searching for answers. But as she gets closer to the truth, she suffers a devastating betrayal and must risk more than her life to save the world from a terrifying fate. The title is narrated by Fergus Bamji.
Omar looks down the hillside again, at the fruit trees and vegetable gardens that his father has worked so hard to cultivate. I am the fruit, Omar thinks. I was nurtured in this place so that I could escape. All those afternoons as a boy doing number games in the courtyard, while his father, Haji Muhammad, wondered if there was something wrong with his oldest son. All those nights when he lay awake with the number puzzles illuminated in his mind like electric lights. All those mornings when he didn't know whom to tell. Those were the signposts to his flight. He tried to explain it once to an American friend, what it had been like to be a boy in his village, and the man, a mathematician too, had just laughed in incomprehension. Karimullah whispers in his brother's ear. He has a secret. He takes the older man down a switchback in the trail to an abandoned outpost of the Frontier Corps where the young warriors train. They have a simple shooting range to practice with their Kalashnikov rifles, and a room where they do exercises to make themselves strong. Omar tells his brother to be careful. These Americans are dangerous people. The attack on their towers in New York has made them crazy. Yes, Karimullah knows. He and Nazir aren't afraid of these half-men of America. He repeats a Pashtun saying that Haji Muhammad has taught his sons. Who today is disgraced, tomorrow is lost. They're almost home. Karimullah is running ahead now to tell their mother that they're back so that she can prepare the meal. The light is dying in the afternoon. The mountains are pink where the sun hits the ridges, and in the shadows, deep purple and cherry black. The sky is a cold, dark blue. The moon is up, but the stars aren't yet visible. Omar looks up by reflex. The sky is empty, he thinks. But then, A ray of the disappearing sun catches something in the sky, a ping of light. He shouts to his younger brother, but he's too far ahead to hear now. The guests are already gathering. Their trucks are parked in front of the walled compound. It's impossible, Omar thinks. These demons won't hurt my family. I've tried to help them. Even my brothers and the other fighters. What have they done to America? Omar begins to run. He's been thinking about what he'll say tonight to his father and his brothers, but now his subtle mind is no more capable of forming a thought than that of an animal on the run. He can hear the sound. It's the faint throb of an engine, and he wants to think it's coming from town, down the road a few miles away. But it's sharper and more persistent. He looks up again, and he knows with the instinctual certainty of the hunted that the sound is coming from the sky, 10,000 feet above. He cries out to his brother as he runs toward the walls that contained his life when he was a boy, and that now shelter his mother and sisters and the young children. Another truck is arriving for the dinner, kicking up dust, and Omar is wailing for his brother now as loud as he can, screaming for his attention. But it's too late. The light is gone, and each frame of time is too short. The whisper overhead has become the relentless hum of a giant, indestructible insect. Karimullah has stopped. He hears the sound too, and he's looking to the sky. He raises his gun instinctively, but it's useless, and he begins to run. The gates of the compound burst open, and members of his family try to dash away, tumbling in their robes, calling on God. They're helpless. They cannot see what's overhead, but they sense it from the sound.
Operation Mincemeat, the true spy story that changed the course of World War II by Ben McIntyre, tells the true story of the greatest, most successful, and strangest wartime deception ever attempted. It hoodwinked the Nazi espionage chiefs, sent German troops hurtling in the wrong direction, and saved thousands of lives by deploying a secret agent who was different in one crucial respect from any spy before or since. He was dead. His mission, to convince the Germans that instead of attacking Sicily, the Allied armies planned to invade Greece. The brainchild of an eccentric RAF officer and a brilliant Jewish barrister, the great hoax involved an extraordinary cast of characters. Ben McIntyre weaves together private documents, photographs, memoirs, letters, and diaries, as well as newly released material from the intelligence files of M15 and Naval Intelligence, to tell, for the first time, the incredible true story. John Lee narrates.
The plan was born in the mind of a novelist and took shape through a most unlikely cast of characters: a brilliant barrister, a family of undertakers, a forensic pathologist, a gold prospector, an inventor, a submarine captain, a transvestite English spymaster, a rally driver, a pretty secretary, a credulous Nazi, and a grumpy admiral who loved fly fishing. This deception operation, which underpinned the invasion of Sicily and helped to win the war, was framed around a man who never was. But the people who invented him, and those who believed in him, and those who owed their lives to him, most certainly were. This is their story. Ben McIntyre, London, 2009. Chapter 1. The Sardine Spotter. José Antonio Rey María had no intention of making history when he rowed out into the Atlantic from the coast of Andalusia in southwest Spain on April 30th, 1943. He was merely looking for sardines. José was proud of his reputation as the best fish spotter in Punta Umbria. On a clear day, he could pick out the telltale iridescent flash of sardines several fathoms deep. When he saw a shoal, José would mark the place with a buoy and then signal to Pepe Cordero and the other fishermen in the larger boat, La Calina, to row over swiftly with the horseshoe net. But the weather today was bad for fish spotting. The sky was overcast, and an onshore wind ruffled the water's surface. The fishermen of Punta Umbria had set out before dawn, but so far they had caught only anchovies and a few bream. Rowing Ana, his little skiff, in a wide arc, Jose scanned the water again, the rising sun warming his back. On the shore, he could see the little cluster of fishing huts beneath the dunes on Playa del Portil, his home. Beyond that, past the estuary where the rivers Odiel and Tinto flowed into the sea, lay the port of Huelva. The war, now in its fourth year, had hardly touched this part of Spain. Sometimes Jose would come across strange flotsam in the water, fragments of charred wood, pools of oil, and other debris that told of battles somewhere out at sea. Earlier that morning, he had heard gunfire in the distance and a loud explosion. Pepe said that the war was ruining the fishing business, as no one had any money, and he might have to sell La Calina and Anna. It was rumoured that the captains of some of the larger fishing boats spied for the Germans or the British, but in most ways the hard lives of the fishermen continued as they had always done. Jose had been born on the beach, in a hut made from driftwood, 23 years earlier. He had never travelled beyond Huelva. He had never been to school or learned to read and write, but no one in Punta Umbria was better at spotting fish. It was mid-morning when Jose noticed a lump above the surface of the water. At first he thought it must be a dead porpoise, but as he rowed closer, the shape grew clearer, and then unmistakable. It was a body, floating face down, buoyed by a yellow life jacket, the lower part of the torso invisible. The figure seemed to be dressed in uniform.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Daniel Silva fans are eagerly awaiting his upcoming novel, Portrait of a Spy. It's out this month. But to get you in the mood, I thought you might want to get familiar or reacquaint yourself with one of his best characters, Gabriel Allon, the master art restorer and sometime officer of Israeli intelligence. In The Rembrandt Affair, Allon is determined to sever his ties with the office. He retreats to the windswept cliffs of Cornwall with his wife. But once again, his seclusion is interrupted by a visitor from his tangled past, the endearingly eccentric London art dealer Julian Isherwood. As usual, Isherwood has a problem, and it's one only Gabriel can solve. In the ancient English city of Glastonbury, an art restorer has been brutally murdered, and a long-lost portrait by Rembrandt is stolen. Despite his reluctance, Gabriel is persuaded to use his unique skills to search for the painting and those responsible for the crime. But as he follows a trail of clues leading from Amsterdam to Buenos Aires and finally to a villa on the shores of Lake Geneva, Gabriel discovers there are deadly secrets connected to the painting and evil men behind them. The title is brilliantly narrated by Phil Gigante.
Peel would always be waiting in his bedroom window, his arm raised in a silent salute. And the stranger, when he spotted him, would always flash his running lights twice in response. There were few reminders of those days left in Port Navas. Peel's mother had moved to the Algarve coast of Portugal with her new lover. Derek, the drunken playwright, was rumored to be living in a beachfront hut in Wales, and the old foreman's cottage had been completely renovated and was now owned by posh weekenders from London who threw loud parties and were forever yelling at their spoiled children. All that remained of the stranger was his catch, which he had bequeathed to Peel the night he fled Cornwall for parts unknown. On that rainy evening in mid-September, the boat was bobbing at its mooring in the tidal creek, waves nudging gently against its hull, when an unfamiliar engine note lifted Peel from his bed and carried him back to his familiar outpost in the window. There, peering into the wet gloom, he spotted a metallic gray Range Rover making its way slowly along the road. It came to a stop outside the old foreman's cottage and idled a moment, headlamps doused, wipers beating a steady rhythm. Then the driver's side door suddenly swung open, and a figure emerged wearing a dark green barber raincoat and a waterproof flat cap pulled low over his brow. Even from a distance, Peel knew instantly it was the stranger. It was the walk that betrayed him, the confident, purposeful stride that seemed to propel him effortlessly toward the edge of the quay. He paused there briefly, carefully avoiding the pool of light from the single lamp, and stared at the catch. Then he quickly descended the flight of stone steps to the river and disappeared from view. At first, Peel wondered whether the stranger had come back to lay claim to the boat. But that fear receded when he suddenly reappeared, clutching a small parcel in his left hand. It was about the size of a hardcover book and appeared to be wrapped in plastic. Judging from the coat of slime on the surface, the package had been concealed for a long time. Peel had once imagined the stranger to be a smuggler. Perhaps he had been right after all. It was then Peel noticed that the stranger was not alone. Someone was waiting for him in the front seat of the Rover. Peel couldn't quite make out the face, only a silhouette and a halo of riotous hair. He smiled for the first time. It seemed the stranger finally had a woman in his life. Peel heard the muffled thump of a door closing and saw the Rover lurch instantly forward. If he hurried, there was just enough time to intercept it. Instead, in the grips of a feeling he had not known since childhood, he stood motionless in the window, arm raised in a silent salute. The Rover gathered speed, and for an instant Peel feared the stranger had not seen the signal. Then it slowed suddenly, and the headlamps flashed twice before passing beneath Peel's window and vanishing into the night. Peel remained at his post a moment longer, listening as the sound of the engine faded into silence. Then he climbed back into bed and pulled his blankets beneath his chin. His mother was gone, Derek was in Wales, and the old foreman's cottage was under foreign occupation. But for now, Peel was not alone. The stranger had returned to Cornwall. Part 1. Provenance. 1. Glastonbury, England. Though the stranger did not know it, two disparate series of events were by that night already conspiring to lure him back onto the field of battle. One was being played out behind the locked doors of the world's secret intelligence services, while the other was the subject of a global media frenzy. The newspapers had dubbed it the Summer of Theft, the worst epidemic of art heists to sweep Europe in a generation. Across the continent, priceless paintings were disappearing like postcards plucked from the rack of a sidewalk kiosk. The anguished masters of the art universe had professed shock over the rash of robberies, though the true professionals inside law enforcement admitted it was small wonder there were any paintings left to steal. "If you nail $100 million to a poorly guarded wall," said one beleaguered official from Interpol, "it's only a matter of time before a determined thief will try to walk away with it." The brazenness of the criminals was matched only by their competence. That they were skilled was beyond question. But what the police admired most about their opponents was their iron discipline. There were no leaks, no signs of internal intrigue, and not a single demand for ransom. At least not a real one.
Ian Fleming's Quantus of Solace, the complete James Bond short stories, brings together all of the Bond short stories in one volume. It's the ultimate celebration of Secret Agent 007, and one many of you, I bet, are not familiar with. Whether he's making an unexpected discovery in the Bahamas, hunting down a Cuban hitman in a wild country, smashing an international drug ring in Rome, or on the trail of a murderous assassin in Berlin, dangerous missions and beautiful women come with the job for James Bond. Whether you like your martini shaken or stirred, I'm fairly certain you'll be entertained by this collection. And I know you'll love the narration. This title is read by Simon Vance.
A single magpie flew out of the forest ahead of the young dispatch rider. It fled clumsily across the road into the bushes behind a Michelin sign that said that Saint-Germain was 1 kilometre to go. The young man grinned and raised an ironical finger in salute and self-protection. One magpie is sorrow. 20 yards behind him, the man with the gun took both hands off the handlebars, lifted the Luger, rested it carefully on his left forearm, and fired one shot. The young man's hands whipped off his controls and met across the centre of his backward arching spine. His machine veered across the road, jumped a narrow ditch, and ploughed into a patch of grass and lilies of the valley. There it rose up on its screaming back wheel and slowly crashed backwards on top of its dead rider. The BSA coughed and kicked and tore at the young man's clothes and at the flowers, and then lay quiet. The killer executed a narrow turn and stopped with his machine pointing back the way he had come. He stamped down the wheel rest, pulled his machine up onto it, and walked in among the wild flowers under the trees. He knelt down beside the dead man and brusquely pulled back an eyelid. Just as roughly, he tore the black leather dispatch case off the corpse and ripped open the buttons of the tunic and removed a battered leather wallet. He wrenched a cheap wristwatch so sharply off the left wrist that the chrome expanding bracelet snapped in half. He stood up and slung the dispatch case over his shoulder. While he stowed the wallet and the watch away in his tunic pocket, he listened. There were only forest sounds and the slow tick of hot metal from the crashed BSA. The killer retraced his steps to the road. He walked slowly, scuffing leaves over the tire marks in the soft earth and moss. He took extra trouble over the deep scars in the ditch and the grass verge, and then stood beside his motorcycle and looked back towards the lily of the valley patch. Not bad. Probably only the police dogs would get it, and with 10 miles of road to cover, they would be hours, perhaps days. Plenty long enough. The main thing in these jobs was to have enough safety margin. He could have shot the man at 40 yards, but he had preferred to get to 20. And taking the watch and the wallet had been nice touches, pro touches. Pleased with himself, the man heaved his machine off its rest, vaulted smartly into the saddle, and kicked down on the starter. Slowly, so as not to show skid marks, he accelerated away back down the road, and in a minute or so he was doing 70 again, and the wind had redrawn the empty turnip grin across his face. Around the scene of the killing, the forest, which had held its breath while it was done, slowly began to breathe again. James Bond had his first drink of the evening at Fouquet's. It was not a solid drink. One cannot drink seriously in French cafes. Out of doors, on a pavement in the sun, is no place for vodka or whiskey or gin. A fine à l'eau is fairly serious, but it intoxicates without tasting very good. A côte de champagne or a champagne à l'orange is all right before luncheon, but in the evening one côte leads to another côte, and a bottle of indifferent champagne is a bad foundation for the night. Pernod is possible, but it should be drunk in company, and anyway, Bond had never liked the stuff because its licorice taste reminded him of his childhood. No, in cafes you have to drink the least offensive of the musical comedy drinks that go with them, and Bond always had the same thing, an Americano. Bitter Campari, Cinzano, a large slice of lemon peel and soda. For the soda he always stipulated Perrier, for in his opinion expensive soda water was the cheapest way to improve a poor drink. When Bond was in Paris, he invariably stuck to the same addresses. He stayed at the Terminus Nord, because he liked station hotels, and because this was the least pretentious and the most anonymous of them. He had luncheon at the Café de la Paix, the Rotonde, or the Dôme, because the food was good enough, and it amused him to watch the people. If he wanted a solid drink, he had it at Harry's Bar, both because of the solidity of the drinks and because, on his first ignorant visit to Paris at the age of 16, he had done what Harry's advertisement in the Continental Daily Mail had told him to do, and had said to his taxi driver, "Cinq rue d'Aunou." That had started one of the memorable evenings of his life, culminating in the loss, almost simultaneous, of his virginity and his note-case. For dinner, Bond went to one of the great restaurants, Véfort, the Canton, Lucas Carton, or the Cochon d'Or.
My guest, Deaver, Jeffrey Deaver, was given a daunting mission. He was selected by the Ian Fleming Publications to keep 007 alive. With carte blanche, Deaver maintains our Mr. Bond as Fleming created him, remaining true to the tone of the original books. It's an incredibly fast-paced story with fast cars, ingenious gadgets, and a new crop of fabulous Bond girls. Deaver brings Bond firmly into the modern era while incorporating his own literary trademarks, meticulous research, breakneck pacing, and never-saw-it-coming surprises. A former journalist, folk singer, and attorney, Jeffrey Deaver's novels have appeared on bestseller lists around the world. His books are sold in 150 countries and have been translated into 25 languages. The author of 27 novels, 2 collections of short stories, and a nonfiction law book, he's received or been shortlisted for a number of important awards around the world. His book, A Maiden's Grave, was made into an HBO movie, and his novel, The Bone Collector, was a feature release starring Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie. Welcome, Jeff. Thank you so much for being here today.
Ah, pleasure to talk with you.
Well, I'm very excited because I am a Bond fanatic. So how were you selected to carry on the Bond legacy?
Sure. About 5 years ago, my book, Garden of Beasts, a historical spy thriller I wrote, was selected to win the Ian Fleming Steel Dagger Award. That's presented by the Crime Writers Association in England. And in accepting the award, I commented what an honor it was because I had grown up reading the Bond books from a very young age. And I counted Ian Fleming as one of my main influences in becoming a writer. And also, stylistically, when I decided to start writing, I kind of used his approach. Well, I think the members of the Ian Fleming family, the estate, were in the audience, and they said, well, this is interesting. They've had four other authors continue the James Bond legacy after Fleming passed away in the mid-1960s. And I think they just thought, let's have Jeff take a shot at it. And they called me about 18 months ago, and I debated about 5 seconds and said, yes, I'm your man.
Well, you are a brave man, and I'm wondering how you keep it fresh, yet keep all the James Bond purists happy.
You've hit the challenge on the head. I have, several million fans around the world. Ian Fleming's James Bond and the movie James Bonds have many more million fans around the world. And my approach was to make sure my fans were pleased with the story I was going to craft, the book that became Carte Blanche, and yet at the same time make sure that those millions of James Bond fans were pleased. My theory about writing is that, or writing fiction, I should say, is that it's all done for the benefit of the audience. If you don't have a happy, good time reading one of my thrillers, I've done something wrong. And so that was essentially what I sat down to do, and I was going to make a typical Deaver book, a very fast-paced roller coaster, but take the James Bond that Fleming created, update him, so he's now a 30-ish agent for the British government in the year 2011, and he would exhibit all the iconic elements that we know from the traditional James Bond.
All right. Now, I know that your James Bond is a veteran of the Afghan War. Can you tell us a little about the story of Carte Blanche? A sneak preview, as it were?
Sure. Again, typical of a Jeffrey Deaver book, there is a very fast-paced scene at the very beginning of the book in which James Bond is conducting surveillance to find out who is behind a mysterious event called Incident 20. Now, we don't know what Incident 20 is, and in fact, we don't find out about it until rather late in the book, but that is this horrific event that Bond has just a splinter of a clue about, and the story follows Bond as he tracks down the villains moves from Serbia to London to Dubai to South Africa, and at every stop along the way, he learns a little something new about who's behind this incident and what it is, and how he can stop it. Again, typical of a Deaver book, the story takes place over about 3 or 4 days. There are a lot of deadlines. About every two or three chapters, it looks like something terrible is going to happen, and in fact, sometimes it does happen, but Bond has to do the best he can to try to prevent this terrible loss of life or destruction of property that is looming every few chapters.
Well, I did want to talk a minute about the locations that you've chosen. The book features many exotic locations. And as a writer, how intimately do you know the cities you write about, or can you set a convincing scene without actually having visited the place?
I think an author needs to travel to the location that he or she is writing about. You don't need to become a temporary resident. You know, writers tend to be like yourself, a journalist, you know, observant and curious, and you know, we're always very receptive to getting the impressions of places and taking a lot of notes and taking a lot of photographs. That's what I do whenever I travel to a location, whether it's specifically going to be a scene in a book or not. I have been to all the locations I wrote about in the book, and you know, I have to say, part of it's just for my pleasure too, because I do enjoy travel. I'm a very curious person, and I kind of like landing in a country I've never been to before, or at least if I've been there, it's under a different set of circumstances. And now I consider myself a reporter, and I try to leap into the culture as best I can.
Well, you know, Bond, of course, the books, and you can't talk about Bond without talking about the movies. So when you were writing your book, did you write it with kind of a screenplay in mind?
Hollywood cinema in the 1950s and 60s was a big influence on me, because the stories are very lean, they move quickly, the action and the dialogue reveal the story rather than lengthy, you know, somewhat boring narration or voiceover. And of the three movies I've had made of my books, the scriptwriters have said, Jeff, you know, your books move quite seamlessly onto the screen. They have to cut down a bit, of course, because the movies are shorter than books. So with Carte Blanche, it is very cinematic, but that was not done with the intent that it become a movie, although I hope it does, of course. But it was simply because that's my style in crafting a thriller.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about, I know you get asked this question all the time, but everybody thinks about it. Of all the actors who've played Bond, who do you think has captured or captures the essence of the original?
You really can't talk about James Bond and the movies without picturing Sean Connery. He physically resembled the character that Ian Fleming created. He was very sophisticated and cool. But for my money, I think I would come down on Daniel Craig as 51% my favorite Bond, for this reason, that in the original books, Ian Fleming created a character who was really tough. He was edgy, he was dark, and utterly driven. And Daniel Craig has that fire about him. That, frankly, was not very obvious within Sean Connery. Now, Connery had the suave elements down, the debonair attitude, and Bond certainly was that. He was Mr. Cool, we could say. But I think, for my money, I'd lean a little slightly more toward Daniel Craig. The others were good, but certainly Daniel Craig was is the embodiment of the Bond that I remember from my childhood.
All right. Well, one of your most popular movies was The Bone Collector, and in it, your character, Lincoln Rhyme, who is a recurring star of your books, he is so cerebral, but Bond is such a man of action. Was it a refreshing experience writing Bond, or was it totally different? And, I mean, talk about that.
When I envisioned who my Bond would be in Carte Blanche, I decided to make him more than just an action hero. And this was for two reasons. One, for obvious reasons, we want to like our hero. We don't want him just to be a karate-kicking, gun-toting thug. We want him to be clever. We want him to outthink the villain. That was in the back of my mind all the time. So I gave him actually some elements of Lincoln Rhyme. And it's interesting you mention him because Lincoln was an influence on me. I wanted to make my Bond that kind of mental chess master. Well, that's the first reason. The second reason is that I did a lot of research into espionage and tradecraft. And spies are really smart. They are sort of the creme de la creme of the government service. And in fact, in the book, in the middle of Carte Blanche, we have a flashback as to when Bond joined. And he was recruited by M, whom we know is the head of the organization. And M says, you know 007. Well, he doesn't call him 007 at that point, but you know Bond. There are plenty of chaps around who know how to shoot. And then there are plenty of chaps around who know how to analyze evidence, but who'd faint at the sight of blood, their own or anybody else's. And he said, you seem to be the rare combination of the two of them. Would you like a job? And Bond says, yes, sir, I'm signing up right now. Mm-hmm. And so I did bring that element of intelligence to Bond, but he does have a really hectic time in the book. Let's say he gets shot at, and a lot of other terrible things almost happen to him quite a bit in the book.
Yeah, that tends to happen to Mr. Bond. All right. So is there another Bond project in your future and ours?
We arranged it so that this would be a one-book contract, largely because, for two reasons. They didn't know really anything about my writing habits or what kind of book I would produce. And also, I have to do a book of my own characters of every year. To do Carte Blanche, I took a leave of absence, so to speak, from my roughly 25 publishers around the world to do the Bond book. And now I'm back working on the Catherine Dance book. She's my other series character. Oh, and then a Lincoln Rhyme book for about 2013. We'll see Lincoln again. But I must say that the working with the estate of Ian Fleming has been a very pleasurable experience, and the reviews have been quite amazing. An author is always a bit nervous when he or she throws a book out there. We never know what the critics are going to say, but uniformly, the reviews have been very, very good, and sales are quite high. The book released in England about 3 weeks ago, and it's been at the top of the charts ever since then. And so it's very likely, but I will never not write Catherine and Lincoln. Maybe we could work out another arrangement in a few years if it were agreeable to everyone. I enjoyed the process, and I like Bond. He's a good character to spend time with.
Your books are so well written and so well received. Can you talk about how you craft a book, and what is your process?
Sure. I am not one of these people that sits down with a blank computer screen and lets the muse direct the story. I am quite methodical about it. I will spend, as I did for Carte Blanche, about 6 to 8 months outlining the book, and that's my full-time job. Well, I should say I do the research for the book at the same time, but I don't write any of the book at all. All I'm doing is coming up with an outline that expands day by day with a lot of erasures, a lot of deletes, a lot of additions, a lot of shifting things around, so that at the end of that 8 months, I will have an outline, in the case of Carte Blanche, that's about 140 pages long. And at the same time, I'll have roughly 5,000 pages of research, most of which I don't use, of course, but it's helpful to have it for background information. Then when I sit down to write the book, it takes me maybe 2 months to write it because I know where it's going. I can write the book very quickly. And then I rewrite. The first draft of the book is always too long, and it's kind of sloppy because I just bang out the ideas because I know where the story's going to go. 2 months of writing and rewriting, and then the book is finished. It's a formula. there's no question about it, but I always say I don't want to get on an airplane that hasn't been built according to a formula, or I don't want to eat a meal that hasn't been prepared according to a recipe. Why should a book be any different?
Well, your books are wonderful and well-loved around the world. I was speaking to a family member in South Africa this morning via Skype, and she was so thrilled that I was going to be talking to you. You're one of her favorite authors, so...
What a treat. Interesting you mentioned that, because I just did the launch in from London, and the book released in South Africa at the same time, and of course there are many scenes set in and around Cape Town, and I did a Skype presentation, and everyone there was very very enthusiastic about my chatting with them, and I got some very good reports from my accurate depictions of Cape Town, which is a wonderful city, by the way.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today. We're actually going to be previewing your book just next on the show, and much success with it.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Fresh from Afghanistan, James Bond has been recruited to a new agency. Conceived in the post-9/11 world, this super-secret agency operates independent of others. Its very existence is deniable. Its aim, to protect the realm by any means necessary. When headquarters decrypts an electronic whisper about an attack scheduled for later in the week, with thousands of casualties estimated, 007 is given carte blanche to do whatever it takes to fulfill his mission. The title is narrated by Toby Stevens.
Of course, he was not piloting a glistening Pacific 231 steam locomotive, towing elegant mahogany and brass dining cars, suites and sleepers, where passengers floated upon vapors of luxury and anticipation. He commanded a battered old thing from America that tugged behind it a string of more or less dependable rolling stock, packed snugly with mundane cargo. But still, he felt the thrill of history in every vista that the journey offered, especially as they approached the river. His river. And yet he was ill at ease. Among the wagons bound for Budapest, containing coal, scrap metal, consumer products, and timber, there was one that worried him greatly. It was loaded with drums of MIC, methyl isocyanate, to be used in Hungary in the manufacture of rubber. The driver, a round, balding man in a well-worn cap and stained overalls, had been briefed at length about this deadly chemical by his supervisor and some idiot from the Serbian Safety and Well-being Transportation Oversight Ministry. Some years ago, this substance had killed 8,000 people in Bhopal, India, within a few days of a leak from a manufacturing plant there. He'd acknowledged the danger his cargo presented, but a veteran railway man and union member, he'd asked, "What does that mean for the journey to Budapest, specifically?" The boss and the bureaucrat had regarded each other with the eyes of officialdom, and, after a pause, settled for, "Just be very careful." The lights of Novi Sad, Serbia's second-largest city, began to coalesce in the distance, and ahead in the encroaching evening, the Danube appeared as a pale stripe. In history and in music, the river was celebrated. In reality, it was brown, undramatic, and home to barges and tankers, not candle-lit vessels filled with lovers and Viennese orchestras, or not here, at least. Still, it was the Danube, an icon of Balkan pride, and the railwayman's chest always swelled as he took his train over the bridge. His river. He peered through the speckled windscreen and inspected the track before him in the headlight of the General Electric diesel. Nothing to be concerned about. There were 8 notch positions on the throttle, number 1 being the lowest. He was presently at 5, and he eased back to 3 to slow the train as it entered a series of turns. The 4,000-horsepower engine grew softer as it cut back the voltage to the traction motors. As the cars entered the straight section to the bridge, the driver shifted up to notch 5 again, and then 6. The engine pulsed louder and faster, and there came a series of sharp clangs from behind. The sound was, the driver knew, simply the couplings between wagons protesting at the change in speed, a minor cacophony he'd heard 1,000 times in his job. But his imagination told him the noise was the metal containers of the deadly chemical in car number 3 jostling against each other, at risk of spewing forth their poison. Nonsense, he told himself, and concentrated on keeping the speed steady. Then, for no reason at all, except that it made him feel better, he tugged at the air horn.
In The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British spy ring in wartime Washington, author Jeanette Conant tells the tale of the Baker Street Irregulars. This small group of British spies was formed in Washington prior to America's entry into World War II. The group was called the Baker Street Irregulars after the band of street urchins who were the eyes and ears of Sherlock Holmes in many of the books. The group constituted the very beginning of what would become M16, the British version of the CIA, and they helped support the fledgling American intelligence service known at the time as the OSS. Among them were writers Roald Dahl, Ian Fleming, and the flamboyant Canadian industrialist-turned-professional saboteur William Stevenson. Stevenson was known by the codename Intrepid, and Fleming would later use him as an inspiration for his fictional M16 agent, James Bond. Richly detailed and carefully researched, Conant's narrative uses never-before-seen wartime letters, diaries, and interviews to create a fascinating, lively account of deceit, double-dealing, and moral ambiguity, all in the name of victory. The book is narrated by Simon Preble.
Encouraged by his superiors to cultivate friendships with important American publishers, Dahl became so close to the Texas newspaper tycoon Charles Marsh that he was virtually adopted into the family. As a result of his burgeoning fame as a writer, he was recommended to the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, and before long was a regular guest at the White House as well as at the presidential retreat Hyde Park. All the while, he was rubbing shoulders with the American elite. Dahl was reporting to his contacts at the BSC on everything he heard and saw. Dahl and colourful co-conspirators, including Noel Coward, Ian Fleming, David Ogilvy, and Ivor Bryce, were all rank amateurs, recruited for their clever minds and connections rather than any real experience in the trade of spying. These Baker Street Irregulars, as they were dubbed in honour of the mischievous street urchins who aided the famous literary sleuth Sherlock Holmes, were Churchill's underground army in America, an invisible fortress that would help forestall the enemy and help England secure victory. They planted propaganda in American newspapers, radio stations, and wire services, co-opted leading columnists from Drew Pearson to Walter Lippmann and Walter Winchell, harassed prominent isolationists and anti-New Dealers, exposed Nazi sympathizers and fifth columnists, and plotted against corporations that were working against British interests. While it may not have been the most honourable way to fight a war, Churchill was convinced he had no alternative. His country's very existence was at stake. By the winter of 1940, England faced an entrenched enemy and stood on the brink of collapse. The Nazis were sweeping across Europe and preparing to invade. Britain's only hope of survival hinged on America's assistance, and Churchill, with the tacit permission of President Roosevelt, who was privately in favour of intervention, despite the overwhelming public opposition, instructed the BSC to do everything possible to drag their reluctant ally into war against Germany. The BSC succeeded not only in mystifying and misdirecting its political enemies, but also in manipulating the policies of its greatest wartime ally in favour of England, changing the course of the United States forever. By pushing Roosevelt to create a transatlantic intelligence alliance in the form of the OSS, to be headed by London's man in Washington, William Wild Bill Donovan, Stevenson effectively made the U.S. intelligence service the willing handmaiden of the British. Not surprisingly, this episode of history, which lay the foundation for the CIA, comes in many versions, with Stevenson and the BSC cast either as heroes or as villains, depending on the author's ties to either the American or British intelligence establishments, and the degree of moral discomfort with their devious activities and methods. Because of the outrageous lengths to which Stevenson and his dirty trick squad resorted in their efforts to confound and defeat the Nazis, an end that, no matter how noble, did not necessarily justify the means, the BSC became an embarrassment to both America and England, charged with having a sinister influence on foreign affairs and immeasurably complicating relations between the two countries in the years to come. There is no end to the mysteries, rumors, and hostile criticism that still enshroud the BSC's covert operation in America. To some extent, the problem is endemic to the intelligence services, where the successors always feel the need to rewrite the history of their predecessors and regard everyone who came before with suspicion, so that no one's reputation is safe. But it is especially acute in the case of the BSC, which was conceived of as a black or unofficial operation, precisely so that if any of Stevenson's boys were caught, they could be disowned by everyone. At every step along the way, they took meticulous care to cover their tracks, both to keep the enemy from picking up their scent and to prevent outraged American officials in the FBI and State Department from giving the show away. For practical purposes, it meant they left virtually no paper trail in this country. What few documents may exist in the classified archives of MI6 in London, the British have declined to release. Complicating matters, Stevenson began securing his legacy well before the fighting was over, and he commissioned a number of reports written by his own hand-picked officers, including Dahl, so as to guarantee that his accomplishments would not be lost to time or jealous peers. Compiled into a 536-page book entitled British Security Coordination.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow. Social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Readers, when you're talking books about special agents, I'd bet you'd agree that Nelson DeMille writes some of the best. In The Lion, John Corey, former NYPD homicide detective and special agent for the Anti-Terrorist Task Force, is back on the trail of Asad Khalil, the notorious Libyan terrorist known as The Lion. Corey and his partner, Agent Kate Mayfield, tracked Khalil across the U.S., but after Khalil methodically eliminated victims one by one, he disappeared without a trace. Now, years later, Khalil has returned to America to take care of unfinished business. The Lion is a killing machine on a mission of revenge, and John Corey will stop at nothing until he gets his man. The title is narrated by Scott Brick.
You never know when you might be sprinting. Jeans, black t-shirt, and a blue sports jacket that concealed my 9mm Glock, my radio, my pocket comb, and breath mints. Beats carrying a purse, like Ms. Sims did. Anyway, it was a nice day in May, and the big ornamental clock across the street said 3:17. We'd been waiting for this character for over 2 hours. The Iranian mission to the UN is located on the upper floors of a 39-story office building off 3rd Avenue, between East 40th Street and 41st. Because of the UN, Manhattan is home to over 100 foreign missions and consulates, plus residences, and not all of these countries are our buds. So you get a lot of bad actors posing as diplomats who need to be watched, and it's a pain in the ass. They should move the UN to Iowa. But maybe I shouldn't complain. Watching bad guys pays the rent. I was the team leader today, which is a guarantee of success, and on this surveillance with me were 4 agents on foot and 3 other vehicles, another Chevy SUV and 2 Dodge minivans. The other 3 vehicles also have 1 NYPD and 1 FBI agent, which means at least 1 person in the vehicle knows what he or she is doing. Sorry, that wasn't nice. Also, FYI, each vehicle is equipped with the whole police package. Flashing lights in the grill, siren, tinted windows, and so forth. Inside the vehicle, we have 35mm digital Nikon cameras with zoom lenses, Sony 8mm video cameras, handheld portable radios, a portable printer, and so on. We all carry a change of clothes, a Kevlar vest, Metro cards, Nextel cell phones with a walkie-talkie feature, sometimes a rifle and scope, and other equipment, depending on the assignment. Like, for instance, a little gadget that detects radioactive substances, which I don't even want to think about. In any case, we are prepared for anything and have been since 9/11. But you know, it happens even when you have a shield with you. High-tech toys aside, at the end of the day, what you need with you is an alert brain and a gun. When I was a cop, I did a lot of surveillance, so I'm used to this. But Special Agent Sims was getting antsy. She said, maybe we missed him. Not likely. Maybe he changed his plans. They do that. I'll bet they do it on purpose. They do that too. Another 15 minutes passed, and Special Agent Sims used the time to study a street and subway map of Manhattan. She asked me, where do you live? I looked at the map, pointed, and said, here. On East 72nd Street. She glanced out the windshield and said, you're not far from here. Right. You have a map of Iowa? You can show me where you live. She laughed. A few minutes later, she asked me, what is that place behind us? Ah, Bone Pain. It's like a coffee shop, a chain. Do you think I can run out and get a muffin? Well, she had running shoes, but the answer was no, though maybe if Ms. Sims got out of the SUV and if Khomeini Weenie came out of the building and got into a car, then I could drive off and lose Ms. Sims. John? Well, my radio crackled and a voice, one of the guys on foot, said, target exiting subject building from courtyard, out and moving. I said to Sims, sure, go ahead. Didn't he just say? Hold on. I looked into the courtyard that separated the subject building from the adjacent building where 2 of my foot guys were helping to keep New York clean by collecting litter. The radio crackled again and Sweeper 1 said, target heading east to 3rd. I saw our target walking through the courtyard, then passing under the ornamental arch and clock. He was a tall guy, very thin, wearing a well-cut pinstripe suit. We give nicknames or code names to the targets, and this guy had a big beak and moved his head like a bird, so I said into my radio, target is henceforth Big Bird. Big Bird was on the sidewalk now, and all of a sudden another guy, who I profiled as being of Mideastern extraction, came up to Big Bird.
Thanks so much for coming along today, and here's some fresh intelligence. I'll be chatting with author Daniel Silva in the next few weeks, and we'll get an early peek at his new Portrait of a Spy, so make sure to keep tuning in. check out my website, bookreportradio.com, for lots of suggestions for great summer reads. And drop me a line through the Reader's Corner on the website. Have a great week, and see you next time on The Book Report.